Right, thank you, sorry.
Thanks. Denise and I will give you an overview of the activities of the implementation and interpretations team. And we'll tell you what we've done in the last year, whether that's as an interpretation, a narrow scope amendment, or an annual improvement. We'll then ask you for your feedback on the effect of implementing IFRIC 21, which was effective on the 1st of January. That deals with levies imposed by a government body. And then we'll finish by outlining what we're currently working on in the team. On slide 3, at the November meeting, we gave you an update on the Interpretations Committee's objectives and the different processes that it has to achieve those objectives. So I'll just give you a very quick reminder here of the things that have changed in the department over the last couple of years. On the ISB's 10th anniversary, the trustees carried out a strategic review of the ISB. And one of their conclusions was that the success of IFRS requires consistent and faithful application of the standards. And about the same time, the trustees also carried out a review of the Interpretations Committee's activities, which they published in 2012. And in it, they gave the Interpretations Committee a much broader range of tools, so that in addition to the annual improvement process, interpretations themselves, we also now have the narrow scope amendments to IFRSs. And at that time, the trustees decided that the Interpretations Committee should have a single set of agenda setting criteria, no matter what tool would be used to remedy that situation. And those criteria include widespread relevance and especially divergence in practice. And that's bearing in mind the importance that the trustees place on consistent application. At the time of reviewing the Interpretation Committee activities, the trustees also formalized the Interpretation Committee's approach to publishing its agenda decisions. Those are the decisions that it publishes when it decides not to take a topic onto its agenda, and it gives the reasons for not taking that topic onto the agenda. Now, these decisions are not authoritative, but they are given weight by stakeholders, and in particular by the accounting firms. The ISB also consulted on its agenda during this period, and that consultation reinforced the need for maintenance. Now, the maintenance role is shared between the Interpretations Committee and the ISB itself. And so you can see that over the last couple of years, the Interpretations Committee is now seen to be being much more active than before. And Denise will provide you with some statistics about our activities.
Yes, thank you. Well, if you turn to slide number 5, this slide shows the level of activity of the Interpretations Committee over the past 3 years. And I think one of the first aspects that you will realize when looking at this slide is that the Interpretations Committee deals with issues predominantly through annual improvements and agenda decisions. And well, the level of agenda decisions, for instance, during 2013, we issue about 16 agenda decisions compared to 9 from the previous year. So that means that possibly, well, the Interpretations Committee has been able to explain the issues by using the current guidance in the standards. So maybe that means that our standards are getting clearer, and then we are able to explain the issue using that guidance. Just to tell you some statistics in this respect, 78% of the new issues that the Interpretations Committee analyzed during 2013, 78% were agenda decisions. So you can imagine how frequent is the use of agenda decisions. Well, as April, I think she explained, that agenda decisions give the views from the Interpretations Committee. They give the technical conclusions. And, well, in the majority of cases, the agenda decisions state that there is no need to amend the standard, or there is no need to do anything further or issue an interpretation, because there is the guidance in the standard is sufficient. So that's one of the main reasons that we state in the agenda decisions. Other reasons, as April has stated, could be that there is no diversity in practice, the issue is not widespread, or there is a post-implementation review going on, or there is, you know, the ISB is planning a project on a specific standard, so there is no need for the Interpretations Committee to address this issue. Now, if you see the graph showing narrow scope amendments here, well, the Interpretations Committee also, through a mandate by the trustees review that April was mentioning, the Interpretations Committee is supposed to issue also narrow scope amendments when it is necessary, so not only annual improvements but also narrow scope amendments, but the level of narrow scope amendments remains at a very low level. So this is not the main focus of the Interpretations Committee's activities, and is the same case for the interpretations. We have maintained them at a low level. Now, if you turn please to slide number 6, this slide is interesting because it reveals the standards for which the highest number of issues have been raised in the past 3 years. So if you follow this graph, you will see that, well, there have been many issues raised on IFRS 3. That's the first one. And, well, as a matter of fact, as you know, there is an ongoing post-implementation review on IFRS 3. Leo is going to talk about that later. And, well, also another standard for which the greatest majority of issues have been raised is IS 39. So we expect all these issues raised on IS 39 to be addressed at some point when IS 39 is replaced by IFRS 9. And I'm sorry, I forgot to mention also for IFRS 3, all these issues that have been raised, they will be somehow, or we expect them, they will be somehow addressed in the post-implementation review. Also, there have been many issues raised on IS 28, and there are a couple of narrow scope amendments that you will refer to later in April on those issues. There are also, one of the top standards in this graph is IFRS 1. And, well, as you know, many countries adopted IFRS 1 in 2011. Mm-hmm. So it's natural that during 2010, a great majority of issues were raised, so before adopting IFRS 1, the first-time adopters. Now, there maybe this is of your interest as well, that there have been many issues raised on IS 7, the statement of cash flows, on IS 1, presentation of financial statements, but the Interpretations Committee has decided not to amend IS 7 on a piecemeal basis. You're aware that IS 7 does not contain really clear principles on the classification of cash flows at the moment. So the issues that have been raised primarily on IS 7 and IS 1, we have tend them to refer them to the Disclosures Initiative because we know that at a later stage there will be a project to revisit both IS 1 and IS 7. Now, there have been also many issues raised on IFRS 2, service payments. And, there is no plan by the ISB at the moment to revisit IFRS 2. However, we have addressed them this time on a piecemeal basis. And in fact, there was a proposal just very recently by the ISB to issue a narrow scope amendment just on IFRS 2. So just gather all these issues all together and issue a narrow scope amendment on IFRS 2. Yeah, there have been some other issues on IS 19, as you know, actuarial assumptions, discount rate, other issues about the discount rate, and some other issues on IS 12. Now, if we generate a similar graph, but just for 2013, and it's not there in your deck of slides, but you will see that more or less the same standards will appear there as the standards that where most of the issues were raised. But you will see also that at the top of the list, you will find IFRS 10, IFRS 11, and this is because these are standards that have been just recently issued in 2011. So you can understand the pattern of questions that we receive is every time that there is a new standard, we get more questions about the standard. That's the pattern. And also on IAS 19, we have received questions because it was revised in 2011. Well, IFRS 5, we have also received some questions. This is not a new standard, but also we've got the collection of questions there to answer. So if you could please move to the following slide, to slide number 8. This slide shows the annual improvement cycles on which we are working on. The first two on 2010-2012 and 2011-2013, well, it's a collection of annual improvements to different standards that we have finalized recently. In December 2013, the effective date is 1st of July 2014. And at the moment, we issued an exposure draft on the 2012-2014 annual improvement cycle. By the way, the comment period for this collection of annual improvements expires this Thursday, on the 13th of March. Those are five amendments to four standards, and we are looking forward to reading all the comments. And also, well, at the moment, we are gathering issues for a new annual improvement cycle, 2013-2015. And we will keep on gathering those issues for the rest of the year. I'm just going to talk briefly about some of the annual improvements that we have finalized and that we are in the process of finalizing and that they have been exposed. So please, if you could turn to slide number 9. So you tell me about the time if I'm running out. So this slide number 9 shows the annual improvements for the 2010-2012 cycle. In this cycle, we had a total of 7 amendments. I'm just showing here 5 amendments. Just to run through some of them, well, first of all, we modify the definition of vesting conditions on IFRS 2 and share-based payments. But this is one of the ones that I was telling you that we are amending IFRS 2 on a piecemeal basis. And, well, the purpose of this amendment was to clarify the definition of vesting conditions. We separated the definition of performance condition, of service condition, and also we answer some of the concerns and questions that had been raised around these definitions on performance condition and service conditions. The next amendment that we did is IFRS 3. We clarify the classification of contingent consideration arising from a business combination, and also we clarify the subsequent measurement of contingent consideration. Also, we eliminated some inconsistencies between the measurement as stated in IFRS 3 and as stated in IFRS 9. So basically, you will find the measurement guidance in IFRS 3 now. We also made a couple of amendments to IFRS 8 regarding, requiring a new it's not a new disclosure, it's just a disclosure regarding regarding management judgments, the judgment that management employ in gathering in operating segments into reportable segments, in aggregating operating segments into reportable segments. And this clarification was made we received a submission from a regulator because they said that these judgments were not very clear in the financial reports, and then we proceeded to analyze this issue, and we are asking for an additional disclosure on management judgment. And also we eliminated there some inconsistencies on a paragraph that referred to a reconciliation of reportable segment assets with the entity's assets. There was just a cross-reference, a paragraph that needed to be cross-referred there. Now regarding IAS 16 and IAS 38, we just clarified how to calculate the cumulative depreciation when there is a revaluation. Apparently, there were some concerns that when you revalue the gross carrying amount and the carrying amount, and you revalue them in a disproportionate way, then there is no way that the accumulated depreciation can be obtained by difference. Through the difference of these two amounts that I have just mentioned. So there were made some clarifications on IAS 16 and IAS 38 regarding the calculation of this cumulative depreciation. And finally, well, there was an amendment to IAS 24 to clarify that when a management entity provides key management services to another entity, well, this management entity has to be considered a related party under IAS 24. If we move on to slide number 10 on the annual improvements 2011-2013 cycle, well, there were also some clarifications made to IFRS 1. Paragraph 7 of IFRS 1 requires an entity to use the IFRSs that are effective at the end of the first IFRSs reporting period, and there was uncertainty about which version of IFRSs you could use. So this clarification stated that you could, that a first-time adopter could use or could early adopt IFRSs that are not still effective, but that are early adopted as its first IFRS final, as part of this first IFRS financial statements. Now, there was another clarification made to IFRS 3, the scope exceptions for joint ventures. It's just that when IFRS 11 joint arrangements replaced IS31, as you know, the notion of joint arrangements was born with IFRS 11, apparently there was no consequential amendment made to IFRS 3. And IFRS 3 remained with the notion of joint venture, but not with the notion of joint arrangements. So basically, it was clarified that the scope of IFRS 3 should refer to the notion of joint arrangements. And regarding IFRS 13, there was a clarification to the portfolio exception in paragraph 48 of IFRS 13, saying that all contracts that are within the scope of IS 39 or IFRS 9, this portfolio exception applies, and regardless of whether they meet the definition of financial assets or liabilities. Finally, there was the Interpretations Committee analyzed an issue where a reporting entity acquires investment property, and this investment property has associated some ancillary services, some lease agreements or cleaning or maintenance agreements, and the question was whether this investment property is really investment property or whether what the reporting entity is actually acquiring is a business instead. So, well, basically the amendment says you should use your judgment, you should analyze the guidelines in IFRS 3 and determine whether you are really acquiring a business and not investment property. So,
okay. If you turn to slide 11 and we just quickly look at the three narrow scope amendments that we've issued this year, the annual improvements are a tidy up of the standard by clarifying the wording or the correcting of minor oversights. The narrow scope amendments are more significant amendments to the standard, and we've issued these during the last year. The amendment to IS 19 employee benefits was issued in November of 2013, and it deals with employees' contributions or contributions made to the fund by other parties. And in the IASB's view, these contributions represent a reduction in the amount borne by the entity itself for the pension service. The amendment clarifies that if the amount of the contribution is independent of the years of service, so for example, if an employee just pays a given percentage of his salary into the fund, then that contribution is a reduction in the service cost in the period over which the service is provided. And the effective date of that will be July 2014. There's also an amendment to IS 36, Impairment of Assets. And this is issued in May 2013, and it's a tidy-up of unintended consequences when we issued IFRS 13 Fair Value Measurement. When that original amendment was put through, it required that the recoverable amount of each cash-generating unit, which had significant goodwill in it, should be disclosed. And instead, it's now been revised to say what the original disclosure intention was, which was that the recoverable amount of any asset for which an impairment loss had been recognized or reversed during the period, that recoverable amount should be disclosed. And then finally, there was an amendment to IAS 39, Financial Instruments Recognition and Measurement. That was issued in June 2013, and IAS 39 requires that hedge accounting is discontinued when a hedging instrument expires, terminates, is sold, or is exercised, unless the replacement or rollover of the hedging instrument is part of the documented strategy of the entity. Now, the query was raised whether or not the instrument being novated to a central counterparty, which occurred in a number of jurisdictions, G20 jurisdictions and in Europe, would cause discontinuance of the hedge. And the amendment provides relief from that, subject to certain criteria. So that was just brought in, really, because of the central counterparty being created. So now we come to the part where we'd actually like to hear your views, you'd be pleased to know. That's when we talk about the interpretation of IFRIC 21 levies. We've only issued one interpretation this last year, and that was IFRIC 21 levies, which was issued in May. It was originally drafted as an interpretation of IS 37, which is provisions, contingent liabilities, and contingent assets. And in accordance with that standard, you recognize the obligation if it's based on a present obligation as a result of a past event, and that's known as the obligating event. And this interpretation clarifies that the obligating event that gives rise to the liability is the activity that's described in the relevant legislation that triggers the levy. And what that activity or event is varies enormously from jurisdiction to jurisdiction and by type of levy. The interpretation is also consistent with IFRIC 6, which deals with liabilities arising from participation in a specific market, and it was the waste electrical and electronic equipment. And the original query raised was, should this be used by analogy in looking at these types of transactions? Now, on slide 13, a bit of background to IFRIC 21 levies. It was published in May 2013 with an effective date of 1st of January 2014. And I think it's fair to say that the interpretation itself, the scope broadened over the life of the process. At the very beginning, it was restricted to effectively the UK banking levy, which came in. But when it was being developed by the Interpretations Committee and then subsequently by the Board, and in particular as a result of comments received on the exposure draft about levies, it was broadened to include not only the 37 liabilities where you're dealing with provisions where the liability is uncertain as to both amount and timing. It was extended to levies where liabilities where the timing and the amount are certain. And it doesn't apply to contractual arrangements with a government agency. So a levy is an outflow of resources which is imposed by the government in accordance with legislation, but it's not tax and it's not fines. And you also exclude contracts for things like the purchase of assets from a local authority or contracts for rendering of services. Now, IFRIC 21 doesn't address accounting for the debit. When we received a lot of comments on IFRIC 21, some people said there are a number of expenses which at the moment we don't recognize at a point in time. For example, property taxes. Now, under IS 37 and under this IFRIC, if you were recognizing the obligation, in a number of jurisdictions, that the obligating event is actually being the owner of record on a given date. So if you own the property on the 1st of January, no matter what happens, you're obliged to pay the property tax on that property. And there were some people who came back in the comment period and said they were concerned about this because at the moment, people didn't account for those liabilities in accordance with IS 37. And they just accrued a given amount each month. And the Interpretations Committee discussed this a number of times, and they also made this point in the comment letter analysis, which went to the ISB for the finalization of the Interpretations Committee. And as a result, the standard doesn't deal with how you account for the debit. It just tells you how to account for the liability itself when you recognize that. And you rely on guidance in other standards as to how you account for the debit. Now, the interpretation became effective on the 1st of January of this year. We've had some queries on it. Generally speaking, I think it's probably fair to say that people are not unclear as to when they should recognize the obligation. The obligating event is generally something which is easy to recognize. The concern is about how they account for the debit, which of course is outside the interpretation. And I think one of the reasons that we have raised this in this forum is that some of the feedback we've had is that I think people to some extent may have taken their eye off the ball for a moment and just thought, this really just deals with banks, it's nothing to do with me. And now they've suddenly realized, well, actually, any levy that's imposed on me by local authority, a government, whatever, I need to now start accounting for that. And we're finding that people are now going through lots of transactions in different jurisdictions to work out how they account for it. So I just really wanted to know, have you had any experience of this? Has this been brought to your attention? And if so, what experience have you had with implementing IFRIC 21?
Welcome.
The European pharma industry looked at this primarily related to the Obamacare tax in the US. And to be honest, you ended up coming to the same conclusion as the FASB did on this. But so we're not challenging the end result very pragmatically, but we're a little bit surprised at the rationale, because under some of the payments under the Obamacare, you actually are are basing them on prior year sales. So, there could be an argument for saying, since they are related to sales in a period of time in the prior year, you could actually come to a conclusion you should be accruing them based as those sales occur, and not accruing them basically the following year, when you actually have to be in sort of in existence the following year to pay the tax. But the basis of calculation is on the prior year sales. So it led to a lot of discussion, how do you actually get to your conclusion here?
And I think it was clear in IAS 37 what the obligating event was. But I know this is an interesting sort of topic, and in the conceptual framework in the discussion paper that has come out, I think this is something that people have started looking at, whether it's sufficient but not required for the recognition of the liability.
Mm. Well, a couple of comments, one question in the comment. As you had noted, and it says on page 3, the Interpretation Committee is now very active. Is there any concerns that the Interpretation Committee members may be overextended with all the activity, given that they are volunteer part-time members? And what are you doing to monitor if there is a concern? Having to do with levies, first a comment. You said IFRIC 21 doesn't address the accounting for the debits, and that's always difficult, especially for preparers, when you say account for the debit in accordance with other accounting literature and then just stop, period. We continuously run into the issue about guarantees and understand liability, but then we have massive debates about what to do with the debit. And it would be nice if you could just, even if it is other literature, give examples of, for instance, if it's this thing, do this, things like that. And I guess kind of turn it around on you is what you said in your last bullet on 13 is, it's not like this is a systemic issue, but it has happened before. And what have you guys learned from this, or what would you do differently? Do you think there was scope creep in this issue during its time period? And then people getting caught by surprise, and maybe it's just the name of it, and they see levies and think it's not applicable to them. But it's happened, not all that often, but it's happened in other situations where people get caught by surprise. And I'm not sure if you guys learned anything or what you would do differently.
I don't know if a board member wants to answer our concerns about the activity of the IFRIC.
No, Notre Dame, I wanted to react to Malcolm's point, but you did. I mean, it was the IFRIC conclusion was a logical application of the reasoning starting from IAS 37, which itself is grounded in the present conceptual framework. And that's a logical outcome, albeit it might be seen as a little bit counterintuitive. If you look at the economics, and this is what triggered probably that we put it as a question mark in the discussion paper on the conceptual framework. About the IFRIC activities, not really. I think a question should be asked from the IFRIC members themselves, how they feel about the amount of work which is required from people, as you said, who have other jobs in parallel and pretty much are very busy with other jobs, and they see too much of a burden on that. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't, just if I can, real quick, don't know what I want to exactly say on this. I almost took Richard's head off in our pre-meeting this morning, in that I get a little concerned about preparers, and that the interpretation committee is supposed to be include preparers, users, and auditors. And I say this for preparers and users. Auditors, it could be this person's full-time job is to do the interpretations committee, as it would definitely not be the case for a preparer or for a user. And where I kind of yelled at Richard, and I don't think he meant it incorrectly, but I think it's occurring, is that since the items are so esoteric, is that the auditors are kind of telling the preparers and users what's going on. Well, that's a problem, because if I have the opportunity to try and teach someone what's going on, I'm gonna go towards my view and lead them in the way. So just something to think about.
Do you have a solution?
I mean, one of the things I think that we have thought about when we bring out any change, and there are lots of drivers of change, you know, new adopters, new ways of doing business, is that we are looking to see if there's a way that we can support the new standards when they come in and new IFRSs when they come in. And I think one of those would be just keeping informal contact with the firms, because obviously from our point of view, one of the things which can indirectly cause diversity in practice is if the firm's manuals start getting it wrong, or if they themselves start interpreting the IFRSs or the interpretations themselves. So we are trying to see if there's anything that we can do to help as smooth as possible of the transition onto the new requirements.
Olivia?
I want to say two things. First, about the interpretation, of course, the interpretation explain how to read the IFRS standard as it is, so they have no choice. And the interpretation they give is with the obligation they have with the standard as they are. But what we see is that, as you say, Philippe, the conclusion are counterintuitive, because some of the levies are in fact driven on a yearly basis, I would say. And there is no amendment as in IAS 12 to recognize it during the full year for a quarterly or half year financial statement presentation. And the conclusion is that the financial statements have a curious trading with that. This is not the fault of the IFRS IFRIC Interpretation Committee. It is because the standards are does not treat the levies as something that is yearly driven, I would say, by the tax authorities.
And one of the things, there was a lot of concern that you would get this recognition of point in time of an annual expense. And one of the suggestions that the staff put to one of the meetings was that perhaps there should be an exemption under IAS 34, so that interim reporting wouldn't be affected by this. But that was really rejected by the ISB for a number of reasons. The whole point of IAS 34 is that you account for transactions in the interim period as you would in the full year. So if it should be recognized in the interim, you would, if you would have recognized
but
it. But
in many cases, the tax authorities or the governments implement a tax for all the year and not for a quarterly basis. And if they do so, in fact, you may have all the charge on one quarter, for example. And that does not represent such a charge of the business for the year, in fact. So there is something that I think should be maybe think of again on the principle, not on the way to apply IAS 37 at it is.
I mean, we have had a query from France, where I know the government is particularly interested in taxing assets because they're so easy to find, and you quite often get a point of time when they will tax a production asset. I looked at that to see whether or not that just could go into your standard costing, so that effectively it would form part of the standard costing calculation each year, which wouldn't result in a one-off charge to profits on that. And it is generally the debit that interests people, not the credit.
Okay. Maybe I should just comment there on what we said in the conceptual framework discussion paper and what the response has been on that. There's quite a long discussion in chapter in section 4 of the discussion paper about what is the obligating event. There were three alternatives put forward. Alternative 1 said it's strictly unconditional, which is basically the same answer as IFRIC 21. Alternative 2 said it's practically unconditional, with some discussion of what practically might mean, although not a definitive answer. Alternative 3 said some events has happened in the past, you receive some benefit, and as a result you expect to pay more than you would otherwise have to do. The responses we got were that not many people really supported alternative 1, which is the one that would be consistent with IFRIC 21. There's no real consensus for alternative 2 or alternative 3, and I think partly because people feel they're not really sufficiently described yet. And so I think there's not really a consensus view on an alternative way forward, but quite a lot of discontent with the answer that's basically the foundation for IFRIC 21. And that's really actually fairly consistent with the reaction we had when we discussed it with the board, in fact. I think the board was uncomfortable with the outcome of that answer, but not sufficiently confident with any alternative yet to put something in its place. So I think that'll be one of the areas we'll need to develop further as we move towards the exposure draft of the conceptual framework.
And is the conceptual framework looking at events from the point of view of what the entity can control and what the entity can't control as part of that? Or?
Well, I think at the heart of it is that one question is the entity obliged, can it avoid making the payment? And that's sort of the root of the distinction between strictly unconditional and no practical ability. It's sort of slightly different views of how soft that should be. I think the other ingredient that comes into it is the notion there's some sort of exchange taking place, and that you receive something and you're paying something in exchange, and if you receive something you should be accounting for that debit. And if you've got a debit, you've got, by necessity, you've also got a credit to deal with.
There is a view which is at least strongly held by one of the firms, audit firms, that the debit should not be directly to P&L on the date of payment, because it's not a tax, it's a levy. And a levy, as a result, is a form of exchange, because you get some benefits, although difficult to identify, of being able to exercise, to practice your business, to be in business, and that would trigger a debit that would be amortized over the period concerned by this levy. That's one firm. I'm not talking about the other firms, but I heard one of the firms really making quite a case about it. And discussing that, I said, well, in some cases you can identify what you get for what you pay. Sometimes it's really difficult to identify any form of, unless very, very, very indirect. And then to recognize an asset based on this very indirect relationship might go a little bit too far.
Yeah, and I think one of the other practical problems was in that for those sort of annual payments, it's not always very clear whether you're paying for something you might have received in the last year or whether you're prepaying for something you might be receiving next year.
Kevin?
A few questions. It was nice to see a chart of what all the standards are, but I'm more intrigued as to who the supplier of the questions are. Because of the basis that a lot, I would guess, maybe wrongly, that very few preparers are submitting questions because their auditors won't let them, which is true, and it's probably therefore coming from regulators, which is, you know, is it really the regulator trying to pursue a point rather than the standard needs clarification?
I think actually in practice the majority of the submissions, which are confidential, a significant number of them come from the accounting firms,
yeah,
where they've been at clients' premises and they've come across these issues and don't know what the answer is, and give us, you know, a couple of views in the submission to say what do you think is right. I think it would be more from the firms than from regulators, but obviously we would be interested in getting views from the regulators. We tend not to get submissions from preparers and I'm not sure why. I think part of it is people are just put off by the bureaucracy as they see it of dealing with us. There is a form on the website. I hadn't realized it was their auditors who were stopping the pen.
Well, it's the auditors stopping the pen, because if you submit, it will invariably go to their IFRS desk, and their IFRS desk, if it can't know the answer, might submit it, but there's no way they allow the client to submit, because you've got to get the financials out. And so it's a bit like this chicken and egg situation, which is sort of the IAS 39, IFRS 9. It's the right answer, but it's too little too late, because it's 2 years after the novation came into play. So all the accounting's happened. So you've still got to deal with how do you get the right answer out in the year that it's needed, as opposed to 2 years too late.
Also, to be fair, we receive questions from standard sectors as well. A great number of questions.
Well, I think one other factor in that as well is that we don't want to, and I don't think we should get involved in disputes between bearers and their auditors.
Yes.
Because apart from anything else, you never know all the facts in a particular case. So.
Yeah. No, I'm on the page, you shouldn't get involved in a dispute. Absolutely. It's more that, you know, if we take the IS 39 issue, January 2014 is too late. The accounting's finished. It's only if these things ever occur again in the future. So at what point in time can we actually get an IFRIC out that's actually applicable for the event that's taking place? Because otherwise we're never going to get correct accounting. We're going to get, you know, the incorrect accounting, in that those contracts were taken off the balance sheet because they didn't pass the IAS 39 test, but in reality they should never have been taken off because it was a continuing process. How do we improve that speed?
I mean, to be fair on the novation case, the board did actually react pretty quickly there once it became aware of it and went through an accelerated due process, and I think a 30-day exposure, mm-hmm. and it was actually published, I mean, on the shortest possible time really you could with any form of public exposure.
The answer is we're not. Or, you know, it's unless we can identify something like we're doing on the revenue one, you know, 3 years before the standard comes into play, we're not going to get the answer.
And I think that's just necessarily a catch-22. By the time we know there's a problem, it's almost too late to remedy it. If you're going to give people a reasonably close effective date, obviously in revenue it's such a significant change that we've got a very extended date, so there will be time to gather evidence about what the effect might be and do that. We do try to anticipate what the effect is in the effects analysis, which we issue when we publish an IFRS, but obviously in all cases we don't pick up what the likely effect's going to be. Sorry, did you have something else? I thought you said
no, it was just that one. It was one of your comment that you're relying on the Big Four. Given my job requires me to read all the Big Four books, you know, there are glaring differences which don't come through as IFRICs.
And it does interest me as well, because sometimes I see the Big Four and think, no, that wasn't what we thought at all.
No.
In this case, on Levy's case, it should not be the case, because levies are by countries, I would say. You have levies in Germany, you have levies in France, and so on. So you should have a common point of view of auditors on the way to analyze levies. So there should not be a difference in interpreting the way to organize it.
Well, we can't do that, though. It's, you know.
It's like if you look at us, royalties was captured by the levies because it's a contractual operation and everything else. And now the auditors are making, you know, we've always just expensed royalties as we paid them. But now we've got to wash them through the inventory line and bring it into cost of sales and change our inventory valuation. Because where does the debit go?
Debit, yes. Up to the credit.
Because, you know, our royalties are payable when we extract the ore from the ground, but calculated when you sell it, which could be 6 weeks later.
But is that in 21? Is that a contract or is it a tax?
Contract. They interpreted it. I know it's the levy says the government is paying it to government. B because levies didn't say payments to governments, it's been analogized further out.
I think we had excluded contracts. Payment made under a contract. I know it's maybe, it's not arm's length. It may not be an arm's length contract.
But see, the royalties are payable to governments in terms of your contracts to mine. So.
But I think, Kevin, your issue relates to another interpretation agenda several years ago related to the issue come from Australia. There's another one, not the levy. Issues come from
there are some mining levies effectively, in particular in timber levies, which fall into IFRIC 21. We found a lot of them in Canada and Australia when we've been talking to
people. Okay, when it says it was surprised by the expansion, it's developed a life of its own.
Maria?
Just a quick one. I do think that it was a problematic interpretation, because I do think that it has been taken even broader than the broadness of the scope. I think it is our concerns are around almost falling back on legal form versus economic substance, and I think the reason for it is because you didn't address the debit, perhaps. That if we had gone on that notion that was mentioned around the cost of doing business, it just happens to be a proxy at a point in time against which it gets levied, right? So. This was a big, when we first read the interpretation, we knew right away it was broader than just the levy, and you go through a ton of stuff that is a levy by nature, things that you treat as a cost of business, because the reality is it doesn't matter if it's applied to me on the date of my financial year end, because if I'm a going concern and I want to be a financial institution, I have to pay this. It's a cost of for me to operate day to day. So it seemed odd that you now have a balloon payment, because the interpretation was the debit is P&L at that point in time. So this to us had broader implications than people think. I think the interpretations by some is broader than you would have thought it to be. And that really, what leads from this is the point you had made in your intro, which was, even when you don't provide an opinion, an IFRIC interpretation, but you provide a reason why you didn't, that is becoming authoritative guidance. And that really concerns us. And as financial institutions, the recent one was the non-viability contingent capital. And the concern we have with that is that it was a very generic example, but it applied the terminology that was relevant. That terminology could be applied much more widely than the example implied. So if you interpret it to go with the terminology, we had a big problem with it, because the example wasn't. At any rate, I think there are much broader consequences of those discussions than I think people realize in terms of authoritative guidance, which is a big concern for us.
Is there a solution to that?
I think we'd need to be much more clear. Either we don't do that level of detail in terms of explaining why you think it is in agreement, or you narrow it completely. I don't know if we really put too many caveats against that decision. Otherwise, you just say we've done our analysis and we broadly believe your current general principles would apply, and leave it at that without kind of effectively painting the rationale and the decision, right? You've basically given someone the decision tree.
I don't disagree with that, but haven't we already been through this? Mm. And so didn't you come to us previously and say no documentation was made, and then people were complaining they wanted documentation, and now documentation is made? And I don't disagree with the point.
I don't
point.
Have that history, but...
Is it, Martin, yeah. I think there is a solution. On those non-agenda items, you've made the call. It might be better if they're better publicized, so that they get accumulated maybe twice a year into an equivalent of a discussion paper or something, so that then you will actually get those comments back. That are you sure that's what you meant, as opposed to the position we've got at the moment, where they appear in the IFRIC issues document, but not everybody reads that document, but they take far more sense if they came out as
discussion papers if the answer's supposedly clear.
Well, but the tentative agenda decisions are subject to a comment period, to 60 days comment period.
Yeah,
so
but
we
they only appear in the IFRIG issues book, and not everyone reads it.
Yeah, but I mean, to your concern that they were not made public, or they are not discussed, they are subject to to discussion.
You're going to summarize it more, that people are more interested.
Yeah, put it into a document that people are going to read.
Okay.
I think
improvements project.
Just to pick up on the point, certainly in the pharmaceutical industry in Europe, we tend to view these levies as a license to operate for the following year. So we've certainly, I think, as an industry, have rationalized that, okay, we recognize on day one the liability, but we spread the cost over the year. Then the other point, I think, also related to the debit is, and I mentioned earlier, many of these levies, many countries, France, other countries, are looking to the pharma industry to finance their healthcare systems. So they're looking to the pharmaceutical companies for contributions. So, you know, the issue is, because they are based somehow on sales, should they be revenue deductions? And that goes back to the point I raised earlier. You know, somehow we would almost prefer treating them as revenue deductions. You know, we're splitting hairs sometimes. There's a lot of different schemes out there. Sometimes we account for no revenue deductions. I know there's a scheme in Italy that's giving us a lot of heartache at the moment. It's not totally clear what your principles are. So we have a lot of heart searching. Are we under IES? Are we under IFRIC 21, or are we under a different standard? It's not totally clear, to be honest.
Okay.
Just quickly responding to Bob's question, because I have been a part-time IFRIC member for 5 years with a preparer's background, and it was quite hard to catch up the meeting, because at the table there are auditors who has been dealing with that issue for years, and then they start talking about it. Then for the preparers, it is quite a new issue, and we don't have much time. We didn't have much time to learn what is the background. So therefore, the discussion itself could be a little bit superficial and dominated by auditors and regulators. So that is perfectly true. Then, what could be the solution? Probably there are some relevant preparers or relevant constituents who has significant issues. So perhaps we could invite them to join the meeting or preliminary meeting or education session. We could do that, but I don't know how long it would take, but such kind of solution could be possible. That is one point. The other thing is, probably one thing we shouldn't forget about is what we are doing is creating a gap. Generally accepted accounting standard, accounting principle. That means even if we create one standard, we don't provide any precise details. Precise detail or implementation issues could be made by the constituents rather than standard setter. So if the principle itself is very clear, then automatically some divergence will disappear as time goes by. But if there is any divergence which would not disappear even after sometimes passed, then it could be a significant divergence. A question is whether or not if we can judge that is the significant divergence or not. So some preparer could loudly say that this is the issue, but it could be a very tiny issue. Or some auditor could say this is the divergence, but this is only the difference between the manual of some accounting firm and the other accounting firm. So we have to judge whether this is really a significant divergence. In order to achieve that, what IFRIC is doing at the moment is they are making kind of outreach to the each country's accounting standard setter. So each country's accounting standard setter may have some idea whether it's a divergence, whether there is a divergence or not. So if we could have a good cooperation from each national standard setter, then we could improve it.
Okay, thanks, Tak. So maybe we continue, and we'll see on the next two slides that
We are.
IFRIC members were kept busy.
Yes, they were. I'm aware that we've run over time, so just very briefly on slide 15, we're looking at a number of things at the moment from a narrow scope amendments point of view. You'll see that we're dealing with a lot of things about joint arrangements, investments in associates and joint ventures. We're also looking at classification of liabilities. And in that, we're looking at particularly where you have a right to defer settlement, how that right is affected by breach of covenants or other events after the reporting date. One thing I would just briefly draw your attention to, IS 16 and IS 38, which deals with plant PPE and intangibles. Both of the standards require that the depreciation or amortization should tell you how much of the asset is consumed over the period. And the standard, the narrow focus amendment makes it clear that the pattern of consumption of the asset's economic benefit should form the basis of amortization, not something which is based on a pattern of generating economic benefits. So consequently, when this amendment is published, revenue-based methods of amortizing, for example, intangibles, will no longer be possible. So that's something you might be aware of. And Denise, just very quickly, is there anything on slide 16?
No, just to add something that you were saying, that will be possible to a certain extent for intangibles. There is a rebuttable presumption that there will be inappropriate, but in some circumstances, limited circumstances, revenue-based amortization methods will be used. I will not have time to run through each one of the issues on slide 16 on the 2012-2014 cycle. However, as I was mentioning to you, this exposure draft is out for comment, and the comment period deadline is this Thursday, so we'd like to comment on any of these proposals on proposed changes to IFRS 5, IFRS 7, IS 19, and IS 34. They are very welcome. And just to refer to the very last slide that we have, slide 17, just to draw your attention on the fact that we've got a website of the Interpretations Committee where we have kept track of every single issue that we have analyzed and that the Interpretations Committee has discussed and analyzed. So if you have if you're curious about tracking some of the issues, you can go to this website, and that is within the IFRS website. And if you've got any questions, well, there are our contact details there. And well, on behalf of me and April, thank you very much for your attention. If you have any further questions in the last 2 minutes that we have.
To Kevin's point about disseminating information, you can sign up to email alerts from that page as well. So if you want to keep in touch with what the Interpretations Committee is doing, you can do it through there.
Maybe a very quick comment about slide 15, the issue of IFRS 11, joint arrangements. What you have here is a short-term project to clarify how to account for the acquisition of an interest. There is also another issue which may come to the IFRIC, maybe in a second phase, which is a clarification of what kind of facts and circumstances should trigger joint operation accounting when you have a legal entity set up to operate the joint contract. You have a jointly controlled entity, it's a legal entity. So according to the standards, there is a strong presumption that it is a joint venture, except when other facts and circumstances lead you to conclude that it is a joint operation. And some in the preparers community and also in the firms think that we should clarify whether the only case which has been given as an example in the standard when the parties buy the output of the joint entity, whether there are some other situations which may lead to conclude that it is a joint operation rather than a joint venture. And I think that many preparers have a keen interest in knowing what is the answer to this question.
Okay, thanks, Philippe. Thanks, Denise. Thanks, April. And
thank
we
you.
Will continue with post-implementation review. And Leonard.